Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the final iteration of Cheer Up, You'll Soon Be Dead, which is a look at Landrin & Wells during World War One. It's going to take the form of two halves. I'm going to be talking in two halves, really. Now, yet again, times are hard. You've paid your £4. I want to give you your money's worth. Just pay £4 to come and see me. It's quite a bit of money. So I'm going to be talking probably for about 50 minutes an hour about the first episode today, which is Landrin itself in the war, with particular reference to the Royal Army Medical Corps, who were billeted here. We're then going to have a break, and we'll stop and the Glenhouse can sell you some coffee, because why shouldn't they make £1 out of you as well? It's quite stuffy in here. We'll try and get some air flowing through here. I haven't spent my entire working career in learning and development without knowing when my class are starting to lose the will to live. So as soon as I see people having very, very long blinks, we'll go for a break. Then we'll come back. All right, so try and stay with me. Okay. I'm then going to talk about the local yeomanry regiment, the Montgomeryshire Yeomanry. These were Landrinded's own, if you like, PALS formation during World War One. Okay, and we'll talk about an hour about those as well. I'm going to show you a bit of film. It's going to be quite nice, so I can rest my voice. Afterwards, a lot of the time, people have stayed during the week for questions and chats and to show me things, which is, bits of memorabilia and things, which is quite nice as well. So that's how the plan is, anyway. It's a basis for change. The RMC in Landrinded. Now, there is very little footprint, almost 100 years later, to indicate that during the First World War, Landrinded was basically one enormous training regiment for the Royal Army Medical Corps. There are some signs. There is one gravestone down in the municipal cemetery. Private Gray, RAMC, who died of influenza in the spy whilst under training in 1915. There is another RAMC soldier there as well. He does not have the military gravestone. Private Gray has both types. He has a civvy and a Commonwealth gravestone to actually indicate his service. We need to establish what the Spar was like at the start of the war. Now, arguably, its heyday was gone in terms of actually selling the mineral water. Hi, do come in. My partner will sell you a ticket. Thank you very much indeed. The Spar had very bad years in the years leading up to the First World War. 1912, for example, was particularly bad because it was a very, very long, wet summer. In fact, more or less like what we've had this week, really. The season was a disaster. There had been another bad season in 1902 on the death of Queen Victoria and the accession of King Edward VIII. While they were waiting to crown him, King Edward VIII, sorry, 7th even, 7th, beg your pardon, caught appendicitis, which in those days was a pretty serious condition. In fact, it's a pretty serious condition today. He actually hovered between life and death for several weeks. While he was doing that, it was actually considered quite unseemly to go off on holiday and be enjoying yourself. So people didn't. So the Spar actually suffered quite badly then as well. Summer of 1914 was quite long and hot, and one could have reasonably expected a decent season. However, people weren't really coming, and the First World War kind of put the kibosh on that as well. As the storm crowds are gathering over Europe, people of Landrinded, are obviously very patriotic, start preparing for war. Obviously, there had been no major war on the European continent for almost 100 years, so people didn't really know what to do. Wars were things that happened overseas. One of the things, of course, that would have had a bearing on this was the fact that the Landrinded Spar system would have been very much built in imitation of the German Spar system. And therefore, at the time of the outbreak of the First World War, there were actually several Germans working in town. And the census records for 1911 show about 30 to 40 of them working in the various hotels as masseurs, waiters, barbers, members of the band. And of course, on the outbreak of war, they find themselves a bit stuck. Those who sort of twigged that something was going to happen left early, because of course a lot of them would have reserve liability for the German army, so they went back to join up. Also, as the First World War breaks out, down on the Dufferin Field, a religious convention is starting. Later on became known as Keswick in Wales. It's quite a large religious convention. There are a large number of German pastors, cantors, and German aristocrats in town for that as well. Now, initially, the treatment of the enemy aliens is quite light touch. In fact, as war is breaking out, prayers are said in the Friends Meeting House in Landrindid in Welsh, English, and German. That's how well, actually, these people are thought of in Landrindid Welsh. In fact, if you look around Landrindid, you can still see evidence of the German influence on the town. People have house names like Carlsbad. Okay? So it was definitely there. Now, first they were told, right, okay, you can't go more than 5 miles out of the town. You have to be in where we can see you by 7 o'clock at night. They were curfewed. Anti-German sentiment actually grew to quite extreme levels, and it was stoked up by people who really should have known better. For example, Lady Glanusk, who wrote very snotty letters to the paper saying, why have we got all these Germans roaming around? Scoop them up now. Because of course there was all this paranoia about people on the east coast of England flashing lamps out to signal U-boats, and all these rumours about Russian soldiers passing through train stations stamping the snow off their boots, where they'd, you know, recently arrived in the middle of June or whatever it was, straight from Russia. Landrindid was by no means exempt for this. The hotels started refusing to accept paper money. The workers of the urban district council digging some trenches in the road was a sign, obviously, that, you know, the Germans were at cross gates and we were making our defences. Quite silly, really. A department store in Brecon called Heinz, H-E-I-N-S, was forced to take out full-page adverts in the paper saying, all our staff are British, all our stock is British, we are a British concern, please stop smashing our windows. Okay. Eventually, the Germans were scooped up. Those of you of certain mature years will remember Miss Aberley, who until her retirement was a teacher at the local school, primary school, had grown up, in fact taught my father. She recounts this story. Her best friend was a little German girl who was the daughter of the bandmaster in the town. And one day she went to school and her friend was sat next to her. The next day they'd all gone. They were all scooped up. They were taken up to Connors Quay in North Wales and eventually sent to internment camps. In fact, there was a very large German internment camp on the Isle of Man for obvious reasons. Landrindid as a spa had always tried to point itself towards the high end of the market. It tried to be just a little bit more hoity-toity than other spas. Okay, now, they suffered because of this, because on August Bank Holiday 1914, when there's absolutely nobody in Landrindid, there are something like 2,000 people in Lanutid getting off the train to sample the waters and walk around the park. Now, there are other reasons for this as well. Lanutid is a lot easier to get to on the train. In fact, a lot of the clientele for these spas, particularly Lanutid, came from South Wales. Miners. Lanutid was just that little bit more affordable than, you know, the flesh pots of Landrindid, so that's where they went. And in fact, a lot of the time, Landrindid really cut its own throat with its attitude of publishing the names of people in the local papers, and the hotels having sort of rivalry and different tariffs to see who could actually get the best quality of people. The result of that was that in the years leading up to the war, when the military approached Landrindid for permission to stage manoeuvres in the area, they were very firmly flat-batted away. We don't want anybody interfering with the season. Now, this in Landrindid is not a year-round thing. This goes on from about May till about September. The rest of the year, Landrindid goes dead ship. And all the people that built places like this, shareholders, all right, people invested in these things as they would in companies, exactly the same as they've done in the railways, they wanted a return on their money. And the danger, of course, of Landrindid is almost entirely in a mono economy. It's almost entirely predicated on tourism and mineral water trades. There is almost absolutely nothing else here. Now, the First World War starts. The season is in tatters. The 1914 season in Llandrindod makes a profit of £19 for the town. All right. Disaster. So as we make our way then through the early autumn months of 1914, in terms of cold hard economics, the town is approached as to the possibility of establishing a training regiment here for the Royal Army Medical Corps. Now, the request for this comes out of Western Command in Cardiff. The people of Llandrindod have their opinion somewhat swayed by the realisation that for every soldier billeted, there will be an accommodation allowance of just over 21 shillings a week. In fact, 3 shillings, 5 pence halfpenny a day. And I'll show you what they expected to get for their money later on. Now, the Urban District Council, realising this was going to be a money spinner, started encouraging the locals to offer up bed space. Now, the requirement was for 4,000 beds. Now, we're talking about Llandrindod here. If you can imagine Llandrindod without Pentrosfa, without the project, without Trevonan, without all the housing around Lant Avenue. We're talking about the hard centre of Llandrindod here. And it's a sort of testament to the town's ability as a tourist centre that it was a mono economy, that it could actually take and absorb this number of people. A lot of people arrived and ended up in private houses as well. And they were, in some cases, 2 and 3 to a room. The only proviso that the military made is they had to have a bed each, which for a lot of them actually would have probably may have been the first time that actually happened in their lives. And as we'll see, that probably a lot of them would have been in the first pair of decent boots they'd had, and it would have been the best food they would have ever had as well. So the various wards of Llandrindod start going into competition, and the council start going out and say, well, come on, North Ward, we need to encourage more. South Ward, they've got nearly 1,500 beds down there. Come on. By about the end of 1914, they've managed to jumble up 4,000 persons worth of bed space, and they're able to notify Western Command that, yes, we can do this. Now, while this is happening, of course, there are other Welsh towns involved in the tourist trade who are on their uppers as well. Places like Colwyn Bay. Colwyn Bay come in and say, right, well, if Llandod's going to do it for 21 bob, we'll do it for 17 bob. And they start undercutting. And it actually does take political intervention at quite a high level to get this regiment move to Llandrindod. Now, I think probably we're talking the intervention of Lloyd George here. Now, he was quite fond of Llandrindod because he used to come here with his mistresses, allegedly, of whom he had numerous. Okay, he was always quite a soft spot in his heart for Llandrindod with Lloyd George. So, as it ends up, the first train of soldiers arrives in early 1915. 1,000 of them in a wunner off a special train to the station. They are marched out of the station, formed into squads in the station yard there, and marched off to their various accommodation in the various wards of Llandrindod. Further trains follow, and the fact that 4,000 troops arrive here in about a week. So almost instantly, this place is one enormous garrison town. Llandrindod as well, early on in the war, the Joint Committee of the Red Cross and the St. John Ambulance Brigade are notified that they are going to have to provide a hospital capacity of 80 beds for treatment. And one of the first people that arrive are Belgian refugees. This is a picture taken outside the old County Club Hotel, which is now the library. These chaps around the back here, those are Belgian soldiers. These are the local VADs, semi-professional nursing. Okay, the head of those was Miss Tune, who was the manager at the time of the Kingsland Hotel in the Ridgebourne. These guys were basically brought over, patched up, and sent back to fight. And they were quite actually well received in the spa because, you know, they tried to pay their way, they gave French lessons, they tried to mix in. Some of the Belgians that actually stayed in the country later on were not particularly well received because they took jobs. You know, the unemployment problem, you know, then was quite large as it is now, and they were seen really very much as, I suppose, they were the incoming workers of their day. So they were by no means universally well received. Here we've got a picture, and yes, forgive me, it's a very poor picture. It's, you know, it's a photograph of a 100-year-old picture taken out of a newspaper. This is taken up by Landrunded Lake. Okay, that's Mr. Margaret Jones's lakeside cottage there. The big oak tree on the corner is over here where you go and stand for the fireworks. Okay. Up on this podium here is General McKinnon, who's the GOC, General Officer Commanding of Western District. At the front here, we've got Major Delap, who was the CO of the training regiment. And they're marching the troops past. Now, they're in files of three, and there's 4,000 of them. So it actually takes 20 minutes to march this column past that podium. A large number of people. They wouldn't let them up on the common in case they churned it up. Same happens these days, doesn't it? Protect the common, protect the season, protect our wonderful resources. Okay. Now, these chaps who joined the RMC... A lot of them joined because they did not want to join the teeth arms of the army. The reason being is they did not want to actively kill people. They were, in some cases, men of conscience. There were great representations in these troops from the Mormons. A lot of people have been in the Salvation Army. A lot of Quakers, some Quakers. There were quite a few Scotsmen in there, and it's believed there were actually one or two Americans pre-1917 and the Americans joining the war. They'd obviously gone over the border into Canada, come over, pretended to be Commonwealth forces, and enlisted like that. Some quite eminent people had given up jobs in their civilian life, and we're talking here professors of theology, notable churchmen, people from the greatest walks of life, abandoned and all that for the duration of the war to serve as a stretcher bearer in the RAMC. Then, on the conclusion of the war, they went back to their previous job as the chair of theology at the University of Oxford, or wherever they were. But some of these guys, private soldiers, had strings of letters after their name that had to be seen to be believed. Now, considering this place became a garrison town, they actually were quite well behaved. I mean, there was, if you look at the punishment returns, there were little court martials held down in the county buildings, and some of the reports of their shenanigans made it into the local papers. But we're talking sort of, you know, small cases of sort of theft, AWOL, and just the sort of general niff-naff and trivia you get in a regiment, and I spent half my time standing in front of people being prisoner's friend for. There wasn't, you know, a lot of the kind of muggery, buggery and thuggery you would get in a garrison town. They were very, very, very well behaved. Okay. In fact, large numbers of them were part of the temperance movement. They were teetotal. So this is probably one of the only times you could say in the history of Landrunded that the churches would have been full and the pubs would have been empty. In fact, one Sunday it would be by no means unbelievable to see 700 soldiers in a church parade at the Holy Trinity. And the other denominational churches in the town would show similar patterns. For example, the Pales over at Llandegly. And yet again, these guys who have been eminent churchmen in civilian life as private soldiers preached from the pulpits of the town, because that's what they did. Because the pubs were not being visited, they actually had to send and set up coffee buffets in Middleton Street, lending libraries, a billiard hall. And this is what they did. The junior ranks had a curfew of 7 o'clock. It was by no means unusual to see junior soldiers walking round the town with a young lady on their arm. But at 7 o'clock, they had to be in. So they used to complain that at 7 o'clock you could unshackle the young lady from a private soldier and shackle them onto a sergeant, who were allowed to stay out later. Initially, some of the private soldiers were actually boarded in the same boarding accommodation as some of the young ladies who were boarding at the local school. And there were actually concerns for the chastity of these yokel young lady, but that was soon resolved when they were all moved into separate accommodation. But yet again, you know, there was crime, but it's very, very, very low level. I think there's one theft of a whip, I think it was, in Bilth. A couple of guys had gone into a pub and had a couple of pints of beer. Same old, same old. And a whip went missing. Of course, during the First World War, it was actually illegal to serve a soldier in uniform alcohol. And of course, there were prosecutions of the local publicans for doing precisely that. Okay. Now, this is a recent acquisition of mine, and I'm very pleased with this. Came to me by nefarious means. This actually shows a group of RAMC soldiers in group formation outside the Commodore Hotel. Now, I can tell by that they're RAMC from the cap badges and the obviously the orderly patches on their arms. I can also tell with a great deal of confidence that this picture was taken very, very early on during the war. And I can tell this because of the uniforms. These guys over here are wearing a standard khaki. They've been obviously in for a while. These guys are in what are known as kitchener's blues. Basically, at the start of the war, everybody needs to get into uniform very, very, very quickly. There aren't enough uniforms, so people just start dressing up in anything they could find, which would be in Boer War uniforms, regimental best uniforms. You end up with these kind of Ruritanian parades of people wearing just about anything. The problem they had is that in order to have a khaki uniform, you need to have a dyed khaki uniform. Now, at the start of the First World War, who were the biggest chemical manufacturers of the dyes in Europe? The Germans. You know, BASF, Bayerische Annelieder und Soda Fabrik. I mean, ICI is German, founded by German. So the first few months that actually British soldiers went into battle, they were actually wearing uniforms dyed with German dye. Right. And you can see these guys here are sort of just wearing just about anything. So probably then, late 14, early 15, just as the training regiments are starting to form up in Landrinden. Right, so what do you get for your 21 bob? This is the ration scale, the daily ration scale for a private soldier staying with a boarding house in Landrinden. Have a look at that and tell me what you think. It's quite meaty, isn't it?
Yeah.
One pound uncooked weight of meat for your lunch. That's 4 quarter-pound burgers. You know, I mean, I have an occasion probably sat down and eaten a pound of bacon in one sitting, but that's that. You know, that's another story. But it's very bready as well. The bread was potentially atrocious. Now, there was no large-scale rationing in this country during World War One. Okay, towards the end of 1918, margarine went on the ration. I think bacon went on the ration. And sugar went on the ration. Now that obviously was quite important for the people of Radnorshire, because when sugar went on ration, it meant they couldn't make jam, which was an important food staple in these parts. With 4,000 soldiers times a pound of meat for lunch is 4,000 pounds of meat a day for lunch alone. The upshot of this is that just about every Swede and potato in Radnorshire made its way towards Landrinden and made its way across the tables of the boarding houses. Now, in reality, there was a bit of a reality checkpoint with this, and the soldiers were able to sort of locally negotiate what they had. You know, and they said, well, all right, we won't worry about a pound of meat for lunch, but can we have a bit of this and a bit of that? And there was a certain amount of compromise. Bread, of course, in the First World War was largely adulterated with things like potato flour and any other sort of bulk carbohydrate they could find. It was a horrible grey colour. It was also an offence to sell fresh bread. The bakers in town. There was a prosecution in Landrina for somebody who'd sold fresh bread. It was a baker's down on Park Terrace. Now, the idea was that you left the bread for a day so it could go a bit stale. It was then, you know, you could thin it, slice it a bit thinner, and people wouldn't eat it quite so much of it. Okay. That was the plan anyway, but it can't have been very nice at all. Now, notable amongst the people that passed through Landrindad in the RAMC training regiment is this guy, Noel Godfrey Chavasse, MC VC Star. Now, if you see a star against any form of decoration, it means that the holder has won it more than once. So Chavasse won the Victoria Cross twice. Now, in fact, in the Brecon and Radnor in 1916, he's mentioned in one of the notes as being congratulated as an ex-trainee from Landrindad. At that point, I think he just won his military cross. Chavasse was one of these people you meet in life who were annoyingly good at everything. He was one of twins. They were the sons of somebody who later went on to be the Bishop of Liverpool. Goes to Oxford, gets a first in philosophy plus a double blue in athletics and lacrosse. He and his brother compete in the 400 metres at the 1908 Olympic Games. They only get as far as the heats, they don't make the finals, but they're doing pretty well anyway. Chavasse stays on at Oxford after his first in philosophy to study medicine. Joins the officer training corps, becomes a sergeant, works his way through medical school, goes back to Liverpool where he's apprenticed to the notable orthopaedic surgeon Robert Hunt. He ends up at the outbreak of war then as the regimental doctor to the 13th Battalion, the King's Regiment, also known as the Liverpool Scottish. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to read verbatim then from his citations. I don't want to miss any of this, what he actually ended up with his Victoria Crosses. As a surgeon lieutenant, Chavasse was gazetted for a military cross in January 1916 for gallantry at Hoog, Belgium, the previous June. He was to gain a Victoria Cross for his actions on the 9th of August 1916 at Guillemont, France. During an attack, Chavasse tended wounded all the day whilst under fire. That night he searched for wounded in no man's land, in sight of the enemy trenches. These feats were repeated for a second day when he carried an injured man 500 yards to safety, rescued three men from a crater on the enemy trench line, remaining in harm's way longer than necessary to bury dead and collect identity tags. In addition to his normal medical caseload, he'd saved the lives of around 20 men. During another action in Belgium in July 1917, Chavasse was severely injured in the head whilst carrying a wounded soldier to a dressing station. Refusing to abandon his position and faint from hunger and his wounds, he continued to treat the wounded and assist with the retrieval of several more wounded men. Over difficult ground. On August the 2nd, he was rested in his first aid post when he was hit by a shell. Chavasse, with at least six more injuries, crawled half a mile to get help. His wounds, however, this time proved fatal, and he died on August the 4th and was buried nearby at Brandhoek military ceremony. Now, Chavasse has probably got, throughout this country, more roads named after him and more statues just about any other person from the First World War, particularly around Liverpool for obvious reasons. There are, however, no memorials or any indication this guy ever passed through Landrindad at all. Maybe we should have one of those sort of blue plaques or something they have on people's houses or something. Next time we have a new road, we could call it Chavasse VC Road or Terrace or something like that. It's certainly a thought. You may have heard of somebody called Lord Ashcroft. He's this amazing Tory party donor who lives in Belize and has billions of pounds. His hobby is collecting Victoria Crosses. Now, he has got about 11-12% of all the VCs ever awarded because he's got pots of money. A couple of years back now, Chavasse's old college at Oxford, St. Peter's, they fell on hard times. They actually auctioned off Chavasse's medical collection, for which Lord Ashcroft paid £1.5 million. All right, so he's not sure of a quid or two. But yet again, no indication at all this chap actually ever passed through the portals of Landrindad, but he was certainly trained here. One of my projects for this year. I'm going to delve a bit further into him. I do spend what I can get up there quite a bit of time in the Museum of Army Medical Services up at Keir Barracks in Surrey, which is the home of the RAMC. They actually have got just about nothing about Landrinid at all, because I asked them. And the only... Yes, it is. But as we'll see, with a lot of this stuff, the hospitals that were set up here, on the completion of the war, all the records were just destroyed. A lot of it went up in the Blitz as well, unfortunately, in World War II. It was actually very, very, very difficult to find out some of this sort of stuff. Now, after about 4 or 5 months in Landrinded, the RAMC are taken out to Penymont Common, they go into tents. At that point, the people of Landrinded are very, very, very sad to see them go, because they've been very nice chaps. Also, in terms of raw economics, in terms of the actual accommodation costs as well, they had put about £100,000 into the local economy, and that was in accommodation fees alone. That's not counting them getting their wages and going into town and spending it. And that was at a time when the Urban District Council was overdrawn. So arguably, the coming of the RMC financially for Landrinda was its utter salvation. To give you a kind of idea of scale here, I mean, £100,000 is a lot of money now, but then the salary for a nurse was about £40 a year. If you went down to Tom Norton's, he would sell you a Model T Ford for just under £200. Okay. As one person put it, they were in everything and part of everything. We then see a shift from the use of Landrinded as a training regiment for the RAMC to Landrinded being used to actually treat wounded soldiers. The guys that went out from the training regiments, they went to be part of Sir Henry Rawlinson's 4th Army. And as such, it was the 4th Army that went over the top July 1916, the first day of the Somme, and the weeks that followed that. One of the major conditions that wounded soldiers suffered from was something called myalgia. Now, these days, we would call myalgia muscle ache. Now, I offer you the chance, if you want to sort of take something away from this, to go and do yourself a little experiment. You see the weather we've had this week. I'd like you to go into your garden, dig yourself a nice big trench, then live in it for the next fortnight and see how you get on. Now, these guys, as they found themselves when they were in Flanders, or indeed all over the world, standing up to their forks in cold water, started exhibiting some quite serious symptoms. The symptoms were very akin to rheumatism. Now, let's not confuse this between what we're going to show you shortly and trench foot. Trench foot is something different. If you stand in water, your feet will rot. That is trench foot. Myalgia gradually became known as trench fever. Now, something like 40-45% of all the people that were injured on all combatant sides in the First World War suffered from trench fever. Now, a lot of the time when these guys were appearing at their sick parade with what at the time was known as neurasthenia, commonly now known as shell shock and PTSD. I mean, every army has malingerers, every army has sick bay rangers. So sort of separating them out from genuinely injured people was quite problematic. Initially, the doctors were, in a lot of cases, were not sympathetic, and the surgeons had quite a time doing this. But it became apparent that this actual condition was very real. Now, at the time, rheumatism was thought to be caused by a lack of iron. Therefore, what better treatment for rheumatism conditions than a course of chalybeate water from Landrinded, which is actually chock full of iron? And my great-grandfather, who owned the moors at the time, was a great exponent of the use of chalybeate for rheumatism. He swore by it. Utter rubbish. But even so, he swore by it. It became apparent, due to further research, that trench fever was not caused by immersion in water. The guys who were doing the fighting were as lousy as rooks. And what used to happen was that the lice would bite you, they'd also go to the toilet on your skin, and the lads, irritated, would scratch, and they would scratch lice feces into wounds. And trench fever is actually caused by a bacterial infection. If you went to the doctor with something similar these days, in fact, cat scratch fever, as they call it, is very similar. He would give you a course of erythromycin, you'd be right as rain in a fortnight. Now, in a lot of cases, these guys did get better. And it's debatable whether the actual treatment or whether the fact they were in a nice clean bed and receiving decent food and having some rest was the actual major factor in them actually improving. They were also starting to use the actual waters of the moors in addition to the kind of hydrotherapy applications, that is actually drinking the stuff. They actually started using things like the hot baths, massage, these newfangled things like Nauheim treatments, or the electric heat on the skin. The foundations of what we would now call physiotherapy. And the guys did improve and were sent back to the front, or in some cases were downgraded into non-teeth arms. The upshot of this is that by about sort of mid-1718, the spa is doing about 600 treatments a week for wounded soldiers. And by the end of the war, the spa has done something like 100,000 treatments. In fact, for the 1918 season, the spa makes a notional profit of just under £1,700. Which is about the last time the spa ever makes a profit before it starts its totally terminal decline and is being subsidised by the ratepayers into the 1950s to the point that they can't stand it anymore. Okay, so they did make a severe contribution to the actual treatment of wounded soldiers in Landrinden. It was only the Moors, not only the Moors that did this, the satellite hospitals around town. The Barclay was used to accommodate soldiers. Granville, Penoir on Park Crescent, the Montpellier, or the Mostyn where it used to be, was also used. The depot for the stores was at Fron Heilig. So really, these kind of little satellite mini hospitals were used. The Rock Park, when actually there was a hotel down there, that had 400 beds. So that was actually one of the... these hospitals... There were quite a few of them around Radnor in Paris. There was another one down at Clisswen. Yet again, unfortunately, getting any information on these things is very, very difficult because the records were just about all destroyed at the end of the war. There were no patient records to speak of or anything like that. Very, very difficult to find any information at all because a lot of them were private concerns as well. The Duke of Bedford's wife set up a chain of hospitals for officers only, of course. Something like 1.5 million soldiers went through these hospitals that were largely sort of set up and run by the communities that that did this kind of work. Because, of course, there was no National Health Service then. So. Now, yet again, in a part of Wales that has a long tradition of religious non-conformism, and indeed Quakerism, it's perhaps not unsurprising that at some stage people might say, well, thank you very much for your kind information to go and stick a bayonet into somebody's guts, but no thank you. And in mid-1916, Radnorshire and Landrinden gets its first case of conscientious objection. Now, you are more than entitled in the Queen's Regulations and Articles of War to list as a reason for refusing to fight a conscientious objection. That is enshrined in statute. However, by about mid-16, we're getting increasingly desperate for men. And what used to happen is that if you were declaring yourself as a CO, you had to go before a tribunal committee. Now, that was normally set up to have two or three local worthies. They'd normally get a local barrister or a magistrate or a solicitor, somebody whose profession was to twist words round. And you can appreciate that some of these guys that came in front of the tribunals were simple farmhands straight out of the hills. They used to ask him the question, what would you do if you came home and found a German ravishing your wife or mother? Now, that is an intense moral dilemma. And as one farmhand from Brecon answered, well, I'd shoot him, of course. Now, if he didn't touch. Now, in a large number of cases, you know, there were very poor treatment of COs. There were those who would not fight in teeth arms but would do, for example, stretcher bearer work. There were those who would not wear the uniform. Now, the Quakers had something called the Friends Ambulance Service, and you could go and serve in that. It was kind of an ambulance organisation that worked alongside the military ambulance organisations. There were some, however, called absolutists who wanted nothing to do with the war effort at all. A lot of them were sent to hard labour camps. Some of them even refused to do that, and they were actually then imprisoned. A lot of them were actually sentenced to death. But the sentences were never actually carried out because Lloyd George refused to let that happen. And in the end, they were just, you know, given long prison sentences, and after the war, they were quietly released. Landrindan's first CO was Mr. Bernard Bentley of the Springs Hotel, Landrindan Wells, who, when called forward, said that the war was contrary to the teachings of Christ and he was going to have nothing to do with it. The board president from Landrindan was Tom Norton. He got about, didn't he, Tom Norton? Now, every indication suggests that Mr. Bentley was actually treated quite reasonably. There was no sort of weasel words or trying to trick him or that. He actually had tried to join the Friends Ambulance Service, but they'd been full at that time. So he was actually held over and given a sort of discharge for 6 months and said, come back and we'll see how you're getting on. Eventually, I think he would have got into that organisation. There were others in Landrindan as well. By about 17 and 18, we're getting so desperate for manpower for the front that they actually were trying to take away people from the town who were giving the treatments out to the soldiers. And they were taking people who were 38 and 40 with a wife and two kids. Now, they were quite sensible normally in a farming community in something like Radnorshire. If you were on a farm and you had two sons, they would generally just take the one because, of course, you needed the other one to work the land. In a lot of cases, in Radnorshire, they actually backfilled these farming places with German and Italian prisoners as well. A lot of blonde-haired people up the Eithen Valley. Say no more. Now, it was possible during this time to fill the Grand Pavilion with 2,000 soldiers to have a boxing match or a poetry or some kind of festivity. And as I said, the soldiers were actually really, really, really well loved by the population. Now, I'm going to show you some incredibly bad poetry here now. Please bear with me. Somebody locally fancying themselves as a bit of a poet wrote, "We heard of them often, expected them long. Now at last they're with us, quite 4,000 strong. From 8 in the morning till past 9 at night, it's nothing but soldiers that passes our sight. Each day they march by, and a fine lot they are too, who have answered the call, as we hope others do. Our churches on Sundays in crowds they attend, so we make them right welcome as we would our best friend. Hurrah for our soldiers and for the RAMC, for as long as we have such, we'll keep Britain free." Stirring stuff. Now, a local doctor serving the RAMC, Lieutenant Seward, who was present at this poetry reading in the pavilion, was moved to reply in similar vein. Now, as anyone who's ever spent a wet Sunday afternoon in Landrindan will appreciate what he wrote. "Landrindan is the place for me. Llandrinan is the place for a spree. It is so horribly lively. As, walking round the lake, I have often said to myself, cheer up, Suet, you'll soon be dead. So there we are, ladies and gentlemen, the Royal Army Medical Corps. As I said, it must, you know, you look at the pictures from the time, they were a massive part of this town. And yet again, 95 years later, absolutely just about no trace that these guys ever came through this town at all. So yet again, maybe we should actually like to have a plaque or a road or some flower bed or something. Right, that is end of part one, because I can see one or two long blinks starting to happen. All right, so we're going to have a sort of 15-minute recess, or stand-easy, as we say in the military. So if you'd like to go out yourself, and they're waiting there to take your orders for their lovely coffee, which you can bring back in, or sit outside and or have a smoke, whatever you want to do. We'll reconvene in about 15 minutes, OK?
All right.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.